This is the Central Saskatchewan Study Weekend. Brother Jim Cowie from Wilston, Brisbane, Australia is our speaker. Our topic for the weekend is the King's Manifesto for Life, a study of Matthew chapter 5 to 7. Our evening class tonight is entitled Signs of the Times, and the reading was taken from Habakkuk chapter 2. Brother Jim.
Thanks very much, Brother James, and good evening, brethren and sisters and young people. Well, it's a delight to be back here in this area of Saskatchewan. A couple of years ago I was at North Battleford and got to know many of you, and of course there are some here also from other parts that we've got to know over the years. Very pleased to be amongst you in what must be our final days before the return of our Lord Jesus Christ. I want to talk about that tonight. I apologise in advance, this talk is going to go for an hour or so, but the reason for that is not because I'm going to talk for an hour. I'm actually going to show you a 14-minute movie in the middle. Won't be time to take out the popcorn, because I think you'll need to focus on that movie, because it's going to have a lot to say about Habakkuk chapter 2 and Ezekiel 38. So the three things that I want to talk about this evening, and we can't obviously embrace all the signs of the times. It would be nice to put in there something about Israel, something about what's happening in Europe. But the three things I want to deal with are the rise of a Gogian-style dictatorship in Russia. That's going to be the main portion of our talk. Secondly, what is happening in what I call the crescent of crisis from modern Sudan, ancient Ethiopia, right around the crescent through Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan and India. Why the things that are happening, that have been happening there for some time now, a decade or more, why they are happening. We want to see what the scripture has to say about that. And finally, because a year or so ago I gave talks in various places on the financial crisis and what we can expect in relation to that, I want to do a bit of an update on that. And that will be the exhortational part at the end of our talk. So then, brethren and sisters, we want to start with the rise of a Gogian-style dictatorship in Russia. There's no doubt, is there, that the bear, who has been hibernating for some time, is on the move again. And this Time magazine that you can see goes right back to 1979, had this, at the time, communist Russian bear looking down on what they called the crescent of crisis. And that area, of course, has always been in the focus of he who sits in the north. We want to talk about where they're at right now. One of the people who knows what's going on in Russia is this gentleman here, Major General Alexander Vladimirov. He retired from the army, and he said this in July 2007, just a couple of years ago. This is about the era of humiliation that Russia experienced in the 1990s, in the early part of this century, being passed. He said, we need to show everyone that the era of humiliation and collapse associated with the 1990s is gone and won't come back. We should not join any dubious alliances or comply with treaties of dubious origin, read NATO. Our task and our right is to follow our security strategy precisely. And so the events that we saw last year in August, while the world had its attention focused on the Olympics in Beijing, and people were running around tracks and jumping over hurdles and throwing bits and pieces all over the place, while that was happening, Russia made a move into Georgia. And that, I believe, was a sign from our God what we can expect very soon to happen. Now let's have a look at what happened to Russia as a result of the events of the 1990s. The old Iron Curtain ran down here. All of this territory to the east, going right across to Vladivostok, of course, the territory that ran down here through south of Georgia, taking in all of these stan states like Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, all of those stan states were all part of the USSR. Okay, that all broke apart in the early 1990s. And when it did, this is what Russia as a state looked like. Now, they had a CIS, a Commonwealth of Independent States. But in effect, these countries that had once belonged to it, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, Georgia, and the stan states, were independent nations, and they went about their own business. And some of them, of course, wanted to join NATO. Ukraine is one of those, and a bit more about that later on. So this is what Russia looked like in 1992. That's one of the reasons why they did what they did last year in Georgia. So Russia's invasion of Georgia was allegedly to support the South Ossetians and the Abkhazians, who wanted autonomy from the Georgian government that is down here in Tbilisi. They wanted their autonomy. So on Friday the 8th of August 2008, the Russians moved their army in. Now you will be aware, of course, that the last 10 or 15 years has seen a tremendous amount of trouble in this place called Chechnya. And you might be aware that not far away from Chechnya is a little place called Beslan. You heard of Beslan? In 2004, some Chechen rebels took over a school in this little place called Beslan. And as a result of that, when the Russian army attacked and took it back, 344 people, most of them children, were slaughtered. So that's a notable place. You see why the Russians are very interested in this area. They've had problems with the Chechens. They've actually quelled them now. They've got a crook, a murderer and a crook in charge of that country. But they want to make sure that Georgia knows that Georgia is not going to get away with its attempt to become a Western nation, to have some kind of democratic system of government, which leaves Russia out of the picture. That's what they want Georgia to know. And we'll see the reason scripturally why that should be the case right now. Because you see, all of us are aware of what Ezekiel 38 verse 6 says. It talks about the Confederate powers that will join Gog when it makes its attack upon Israel, in fact, into Egypt initially. That's, of course, the subject of Ezekiel 38 that we're all familiar with. But it mentions as one of the participants, one of the Confederate powers, the House of Togarmah. Now, Togarmah is the name of the Armenians. Here are the Armenians here, who are still called the House of Thorgum or Torkomatsi, say Kiel and Dalish in their commentary. So this is the area described when it talks about the House of Togarmah. Why house? Why not just say Gomer, for instance? Doesn't say the House of Gomer. Doesn't say the House of Ethiopia. Doesn't say the House of Libya. Why house? Well, you see, the Armenians were crushed and scattered by the Turks during, or just a bit after, the First World War. 1918 to 1922, there was a genocide in Armenia, and the Turks wiped out literally hundreds of thousands of them. And so the Armenians had to scatter. Some went north, some went south. So they tried to hide from this genocide. But they're all in this area, in this region. Some are in Georgia. Some are down here in northern Iraq. They are the House of Togarmah. These are the people that will join Gog in its invasion upon the land of Israel. There's also Kurds in this region. Kurds are, of course, they're a carryover from the Old Testament Chaldees. They're the remnant of the Chaldeans. So here we have the reason I believe Russia is making its move into this area. Russia is arming Togarmah. It was reported on August 24th, 2007, on Newsline that Robert Kacharian, he's the president of Armenia, travelled to Sochi, which just happens to be near the border with Georgia, for talks there with Russian President Putin. The talks focused on energy cooperation, including the price Armenia will pay for Russian gas in 2009. However, perhaps the most important piece of news was this. Meanwhile, a shipment of some 300 tons of Russian military equipment removed from the Russian military base at Batumi in Georgia was due to reach Armenia on August the 23rd, 2007. So Russia, because of its unfriendly relations with Georgia, was closing down one of its military bases in Georgia and shifting the weapons not back to Russia, but south. South into Armenia, the next country down from Georgia. And they were making preparations then to swallow up Georgia. So their move last year was according to their plan. So here is Russian, and there's Sochi, by the way, and here's the Georgian border. Their plan is to take this territory. They've already got control of Abkhazia, which is almost a quarter. They've got control of South Ossetia. Now they just need to topple the government in Tbilisi and they can control the whole of Georgia and they will soak up the ancient territory of Togarmah. And Ezekiel 38 verse 6 will be prepared. There's Batumi, by the way, the base that they closed. Now then, again we are familiar with these words of Ezekiel 38 verse 2, but here are a couple of literal translations. Rotherhand's translation of the second verse of this chapter is, "Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy concerning him." The Amplified Bible is not much different. "Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog." The phrase I want you to remember, tuck this one away in the memory box for a while, is this phrase here. Gog is a reference to a dictator. It's an individual. He's an individual, a dictator. But he is of the land of Magog, interestingly enough. That's like saying you have a speaker of the land of Australia. I'm not one of you North Americans, okay? I'm of the land of Australia. So Gog is not a Russian, necessarily. He's of the land of Magog. Or he has a title to the Russian throne because he's Prince of Rosh, the most ancient form of the name Russia, Meshech, the Muscovites, and Tubal, the Siberians. All right, so he's got a title to the throne, but he is of the land of Magog. Tuck it away, because we're going to talk about that a little later on. Now here is Unger's Bible Dictionary on Ezekiel 38 and 39. He says, "which deal with Gog the prince and Magog his land." He's got that right, see? It's unusual for an apostate commentator to get it right, but he's got that right. Magog his land. "Describe the actual invasion of Palestine as it was in his time by a great northern confederacy ostensibly headed up by Russia." He's got that right too. The scene depicts a gigantic outburst of anti-Semitism, etc. And then we read in verses 5 to 7 of Ezekiel 38 these words, "Persia, Ethiopia and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet." Now I'm going to talk briefly in a moment in our second section about Persia, Ethiopia and Libya. We're going to see the connection between those powers. We're going to see what's happening right now. In fact, what's been happening for the last 10 years in Sudan is directly related to that. But I want to focus perhaps a bit more at this stage on Gog, the dictator. We've talked about the house of Togarmah, of course. The countries north of Israel, eastern Turkey and Armenia are the areas of Togarmah. And we know from Ezekiel 38 verses 5 to 7, verse 7 says, "Be thou prepared, Gog, and prepare for thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them." This word in the Hebrew, guard, mishmar, means a guard of a prison. And Jesenius says a custodian, someone who locks up nations. Now we've read tonight from Habakkuk chapter 2, and we're going to have a look at that chapter fairly closely and see the character of the dictator that's being described here in Ezekiel 38. I want you to come to Habakkuk chapter 2. I want to see the context of this chapter first of all. Let's establish where we are in the scheme of things. We read verse 3, "For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come." It will not tarry, it seems to many, as though it is tarrying. But brethren and sisters and young people, the signs are there that it's not going to tarry much longer. You're going to see that very clearly. We have a Gogian-style dictatorship in Russia. And that's been developed in the last 6, 7 or 8 years. So it's a recent thing. We didn't have it in the 90s when some people said, "Oh, well, maybe we weren't right on that." We've got it now. And we have to see it for what it is. It's a clear indication that the appointed time is near. In verse 4 we read about two characters. They are directly contrasted. There are those like you and me who fit the first words of verse 4, the first words of verse 4 are about the other class. "Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him." This is about the dictator that was going to come into the land of Israel in the times of the prophet. The second class, you and me, are in the end of verse 4, "but the just shall live by his faith." So the faithful have a sure destiny. But the dictator, whose heart is lifted up in pride, is going to be the head of the other army. The saints with Christ will face this dictator in the land of Israel. So we need to know a bit about him. And Habakkuk chapter 2 is going to tell us a bit about him. Now in the days of the prophet, he was talking about the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans were going to come down upon the land of Judah. They were going to take away God's people and bring divine judgment upon them. And of course Habakkuk didn't want that to happen. That's what he says in verse 1, I will stand upon my watchtower, and when he shall answer, I'll be reproved. He knew he would be reproved. He didn't want it to happen. But you see, God told him something about the character of the Chaldean dictator, not just for those times. He told him about the character of the dictator who would come down upon the land of Israel in the days in which you and I live. How do we know that? How do we know we're in this context? Well, there's verse 14. This is about the establishment of the kingdom of God. The earth should be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. If we had any doubt about the context, verse 20. Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Any doubt? Well, if there was doubt, the next chapter, Habakkuk chapter 3, gives a detailed list of the places that the mighty rainbowed angel of Revelation chapter 10 will take in his conquest of the nations. So there's no doubt about the context of Habakkuk. Habakkuk 2, though it is based upon the history of the time when the Chaldeans came into the land of Judah, is actually talking about our days. And therefore, when we read about this dictator, we should find characteristics of the dictatorship of Gog. And you know what? That's exactly what we find in Habakkuk chapter 2. This book ends with these words, Habakkuk 3 verse 18. Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. And I hope that after we've considered these things briefly, that that's the way we'll feel about this. That we will feel that we are near the time, and that we will make the necessary preparations, brethren and sisters and young people, to ensure that we are part of the company of Christ, the mighty rainbowed angel, when he comes to destroy this dictator upon the mountains of Israel. So look at him. Let's take a close look at him. He's corrupt. We read that from verse 4. He's an oppressor. In verse 5 we read this. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine. He is a proud man. So he's noted for drunkenness and pride. We read on in that verse, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as the grave, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied. So he's insatiable in his expansionism. It goes on to say in verse 5, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all peoples. So he's one of those who cannot be satisfied by conquest. He has to keep on taking into his embrace and control nations that are around him. It's talking about a dictatorship. Verse 6 talks about his methods. Shall not all these, those nations who suffer at his hand, take up a parable against him and a taunting proverb against him and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay. I want to come back to that phrase, thick clay, because that is actually describing exactly what Russia is doing right now. Lading himself with thick clay. We'll return to that in a minute. Let's go on. Verse 8. Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. Because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of them that dwell therein. So he's ruthless in spoiling nations, cities, and innocent people. You know, the track record of Vladimir Putin in relation to Chechnya should tell other nations how he operates. He don't care about anybody. If it requires the death of thousands of people, or even say 118 submariners, for his purpose, he couldn't care less about human life. You're going to see that tonight in the movie. Verse 9, we read this. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, and that he may be delivered from the power of evil. That's telling us that he uses religion to hide and to justify his actions. He hides behind religion, as we're going to see. In verse 12, he builds his empire by fire and blood. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth the city by iniquity. In verse 15, he uses base practices to undermine others. I'm going to ask you a question. Do you know how Vladimir Putin came to power in Russia? How did this obscure KGB agent, who spent 10 years in East Germany, within a few years end up being the president of Russia? He came out of nowhere. How did that happen? Well, verses 15 and 16 describe what happened. This is how he got his power. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink, that putteth thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Now, drunkenness in Russia is a particularly serious problem. They lose hundreds of thousands of people a year from cirrhosis of the liver. Boris Yeltsin, who died in 2004, was one of them. So drunkenness is a problem. And this man Putin knows how to use it for his purpose. You know, in the latter portion of the last century, about 1998-1999, when Yeltsin was in the last years of his presidency, he appointed a premier called Primakov. Now, Primakov wanted to make a name for himself in this time of openness in Russia. So he appointed a prosecutor to investigate the finances of the Kremlin, because they knew that Yeltsin's family, as they called it, his wider family, were fiddling the books, and they had their hand in the till to the tune of 50-odd billion dollars. It's a lot of money. Money was going out the back door. So Primakov set out to investigate, and his prosecutor found evidence that the Yeltsin family was fiddling the books. They want to go to trial. Yeltsin rang up his newly appointed head of the FSB, the old KGB, the Russian secret service, secret police, and he said to Mr. Putin, "Vladimir, can you help me?" He said, "Don't worry, Mr. President, leave it to me." Vladimir Putin arranged for a safe KGB house to be provided with a couple of women of dubious character, need I say more, and a fridge full of vodka and other liquors to be made available, and the prosecutor was invited in. He was filmed by video, obviously, in a situation very compromising. And that video was shown on Russian television the next night. End of case, end of Yeltsin's problem, and when he came to retire on the last day of the last century, December the 31st, 1999, he handed the briefcase, unbeknown to most people. It was a surprise to most Russians. He handed a briefcase with the nuclear codes to Vladimir Putin. Now that is telling you that this obscure man came to power by very devious means. He did exactly what Habakkuk 2:15 and 16 said he would do. Thou puttest thy bottle to him that thou mayest see his nakedness. And that prosecutor's nakedness was publicised on Russian television. That's how Putin came to power. So you see, the Bible's very specific, isn't it? Now, I'm not going to suggest to you that that's exactly what was intended, but it certainly fits. That's how it came to pass. And we need to think about this, because you see, God's actually given us a lot of information about this dictatorship. In verses 18 and 19, he also tells us this. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image, and the teacher of lies that the maker of his work trusteth therein to make dumb idols? There is no worse religion on earth for idolatry than the Russian Orthodox Church. And they have control in Russia today. They back Yeltsin as president. They back Putin as president, because, of course, Putin
at least he alleges to be a religious man. And you see pictures of him kissing idols, all sorts of images of Mary and bits and pieces of that religion. He makes himself out to be a servant of the church. At his inauguration, he received the blessing of Alexei II, who's now, of course, since died last year. He was a German, by the way. He was put in charge of the Russian Orthodox Church in the 1960s because he was actually a KGB agent. That's how they controlled the church. Now, here he is with Putin, who's already got sore lips from kissing all of these idols. But this is what Putin said. I want you to consider these words. He says, "I consider it my sacred duty to unite the people of Russia and to gather citizens around the clearly defined tasks and aims and to remember every minute of every day." Now, wouldn't that be nice if Christadelphians could say about our commitment to the truth that we are going to be involved in that every minute of every day? He is. He's totally committed to doing this, uniting the nation. We are one people. We have one common destiny. You know how he's done that? He's done it by creating a dictatorship where one man sits at the top, vertical line of power. Nobody else gets in the way. He dictates what will happen. That's the kind of dictatorship this man has created in Russia. Now let's go back to that phrase at the end of verse 6. "And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay." What does it mean? Well, it's in this context. "He gathereth unto him all nations." How does he do that? What's his method? Lading himself with thick clay. This word in the Hebrew means the weight of pledges. Now, a pledge is where you pledge something. You say, "I'm going to do this. I'm committed to do this." So he's getting pledges from these nations that he's gathering unto him. How's he doing that? Well, he's doing it by controlling resources. Russia has the greatest reserves of mineral resources of any country in the world. It is especially rich in mineral fuels. It has the world's largest natural gas reserves, the second largest coal reserves, the eighth largest oil reserves. It's among the world leaders in the deposits of iron ore, asbestos, zinc, nickel, cobalt, diamonds, potassium, lead, gold, platinum, uranium. I think they miss silver. It's not a bad list, is it? And what are they doing with that? Well, Russia currently supplies over 25% of Germany's gas requirements. In a decade, that will exceed 80%. And when they are feeding 80% of Germany's and the rest of Europe's gas supplies in there, then the European nations are not going to be able to say no. I'll show you in a moment. In this film, you watch what happened to Ukraine in 2006. And you'll get an indication of what Russia is going to do to the rest of the European nations in the future. They're just simply going to turn the tap off. You know what they're going to do? It'd be useless doing this in Brisbane. We don't have a winter. But here, in this country, they wait till December and January. And then they turn the gas tap off. Well, you've got no house heating. And people freeze. All right, that's what they do. He's going to lay himself with thick clay, with the weight of pledges. He's going to control people like this. You know, he's going to do that for the European nations, but there's a different tactic we're going to see when it comes to the nations to the south, to Persia, to Ethiopia, Libya, etc., and the countries of Afghanistan and Pakistan that will become subject to Russian control before Armageddon, as we shall see. He'll use a different method there. It will be the method of conquest. But here in Europe, it's going to be this kind of thing. Binding nations by pledges. They will have to do what Russia requires. There won't be any questions asked. So the rise of this dictator. What drives this once obscure man from St. Petersburg? Very friendly face. Sort of face you'd want to meet on someone you're going to buy a car from. Okay? What drives this man? You notice he's from St. Petersburg? Just keep that in mind. Well, the Russian oligarchs underestimated him. The internal opposition in the CIS underestimated him. European nations underestimated him. And so did the United States of America. What drives him? Well, this is what drives him. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989. It was the beginning of the fall of the USSR and communism. And Vladimir Putin said about that collapse,
It is the greatest geopolitical disaster in history. Now that's a huge statement. The greatest geopolitical disaster in history. So that's what motivates him. He felt that the fall of the USSR was the worst thing that ever happened in history. And he determined way back then, when he was in East Germany, because that's what that was happening. 89, he was in East Germany as just an ordinary KGB agent. He determined then that he was going to reverse that. Well, it's time to see what happened. Just give me half a second. Habakkuk chapter 2. Look carefully enough, that's what it is. But you might think now, I'm going to say that Vladimir Putin is Gog. I'm not. Because I don't believe he is. There's an important lesson to be learned in what I'm saying here this evening, brethren and sisters. It is this. Brother Thomas taught us this lesson. He interpreted the Bible. He didn't look at what was happening and say, well, I think this scripture is saying that. He interpreted what the scripture said. It didn't matter really what was happening around him. And where he saw evidence that that's the way it was going, he would highlight that. The Bible is very clear. The scripture makes it very clear. Remember this passage? Son of man, set thy face against Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy concerning him. Gog is from the land of Magog. Now historians have argued about Magog for centuries, but the extent of the boundary of Magog, the fullest extent, doesn't include St. Petersburg, and that's where Putin came from. So whatever you think about Magog, we talk about Magog being Germany. Well, it had other boundaries. Its boundaries came out to here, included Ukraine. But it doesn't include the birthplace of Vladimir Putin. And that's why I believe he's not Gog. What he has done, however, he has established the system. The dictatorship. He's got vertical power in Russia. He's still the most powerful man, even though the Constitution doesn't allow him to be president. He's still unquestionably the most powerful man in Russia. He's the Prime Minister, of course, has more power than Medvedev. But he doesn't come from Magog. Now then, let's talk about the Tsars. Because the Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, wants the Tsarist regime to be restored. In fact, Putin himself has spent over $2 billion restoring the Tsarist heritage in St. Petersburg. He spent money on the Hermitage Museum. He spent money on the Palace of the Tsars. He reinterred the Tsars. The last Tsar, Nicholas II and his family, who were, of course, executed by the Bolsheviks in 1917 in central Russia. They dug them up. They reinterred them in St. Petersburg. Why would they do that? What's happening? Well, the Church, of course, wants the Tsarist regime back. Izvestia reported on the 14th of June 2007 that the beginning of a major campaign had started with the replacement of Soviet-era flags for 2,135 military units. It's going to take 3 years, they said. The new enzymes will use Tsarist symbols. The double-headed eagle, of course, came from Constantinople. It was the heraldry of the Eastern Roman Empire, and particularly of its religion. And when the Turks in 1453 took Constantinople, the Eastern Orthodox Church had to find a new home. And the Tsar of Russia says, I'm looking for a religion. So he took that religion to Moscow. That became its headquarters. And so Moscow became known as the Third Rome in history. Constantinople had been the Second Rome, of course, built on seven hills, like the first one. So this campaign to replace the old USSR, the hammer and sickle type symbols, with the Tsarist symbol, double-headed eagle and crowns, etc., is well underway. They're making good progress. And you might have noticed that Putin was standing in front of this sort of imagery when he was in Ukraine and when he was inaugurated.
This is the double-headed eagle. There are the two heads of the eagle. As I said, it's the symbol of the Eastern Roman Empire, and we know that Russia, or Gog, is going to take control of Constantinople, become the king of the north, and the little horn of the goat of Daniel. So that is very interesting indeed. But notice this here. This gentleman on the white horse slaying a dragon. This is a representation of Russia. Russia is the gentleman on the horse, depicted as the man-child Michael slaying the dragon. They've got that from Revelation 12, of course, all mixed up. But that's where that imagery comes from. So this is about religion. Religious control of Russia. Now just 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, if you'd said that the church would come back and control politics in Russia, you would have had to be taken to a psychologist. But it's happened. It's happening. And Yeltsin and Putin couldn't rule without the backing of the church. Now then, who might Gog be? Well, here's an obituary from the Daily Telegraph, 23rd of April 1992. This gentleman here, His Imperial Highness, the Grand Duke Vladimir of Russia, died in Miami, Florida, aged 74. He claimed to be the head of the House of Romanov, the Russian royal family name. And so the rightful emperor and autocrat of all the Russias. In purely genealogical terms, his claim seems straightforward enough, says the article, for he was undoubtedly the senior living descendant of Emperor Alexander II, who ruled from 1855 to 1881 when he was blown up in St. Petersburg by a bomb. He is survived by his wife and their daughter Maria, who was born in Madrid in 1953, and married, here's the interesting part, married Prince Franz Wilhelm of Prussia, read Germany. They have a son. Did you know in history, brethren and sisters, that the Russian royal family regularly married into the German royal family? Catherine the Great, you'll recall, one of the greatest Russian empresses, was a German. It's alleged she poisoned her husband, Peter III, because he was alleged to be stupid. So she got rid of him, and she became a very powerful world ruler. It was common practice for the Russian royal family to marry into the German royal family. So by the time of the last Tsar, Nicholas II, in 1917, when he was shot, the Russian emperors were three-quarter German. Three-quarter German. Grand Duke Vladimir declared Grand Duchess Maria, his daughter, the sole heiress to the throne and caused further controversy in Russian royal circles by proceeding to create, quite unprecedentedly, his German son-in-law, a Grand Duke. Now, this is Canada. You have a queen. Australia has a queen. Who's the successor to the throne? Well, it's the Prince of Wales, isn't it? One would hope that he doesn't make it. But anyway, it is the Prince of Wales. Well, he's the equivalent of the Russian Grand Duke. A Grand Duke is next in line to the throne. So this gentleman here, Vladimir, passed on his heirship to his daughter Maria, but then created her husband, this German fellow, Prince Franz Wilhelm of Prussia or Germany, the Grand Duke, next in line to the throne. Grand Duke Vladimir foresaw the beginning of a new dynasty of Hohenzollern-Romanov. Hohenzollern, German royal family name. Romanov, Russian royal family name. He foresaw that those two royal families would be reunited. Son of man, set thy face unto Gog of the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. From Germany is Gog, but he has a title to the Russian throne. Prince. He's royalty. Here's the line. There's Nicholas I up there. Here is the family that was slaughtered by the Bolsheviks. Here, Nicholas II and his wife and their children, five children. So the line went over here. It came down through this gentleman. He was the guy who died in 1992. Here's his wife, Leonida. She's still alive. Here's his daughter, Maria. They had a son, did she and her husband, Prince Franz Wilhelm. Born in 1981, his name is Prince Georgi Romanov. Mathematicians in the audience. How old is he? 28, 29 perhaps, a bit later on. 28. When Christ comes tomorrow, it'll be 10 years before Armageddon, which
which means he would be 38, 39, prime of life. Plenty of time for things to happen. Some of you will say, why 10 years? That's another story, but it will be 10 years. Let me assure you of that. Could be. Brother Thomas said this. A Tsar of Russia will be both Emperor of Germany and autocrat of all the Russias. Help Us Israel, page 432. It's heading in that direction, brethren and sisters. Very, very quickly. Now, for our second part, you need to focus a bit. I want to talk quickly. I have to talk quickly. When I talk about the troubles in the Middle East as a precursor for Nebuchadnezzar's image formation. Sudan, what's been happening there? Well, Sudan occupies the ancient territory of Kush, or Ethiopia. So Ethiopia of the modern world is down here. Only a portion of modern Ethiopia is part of the original Kush, or Ethiopia. Most of the original Kush is the country of Sudan today. Now, you know what's been happening here. You've got people living in your country, as we have in ours, who come from this region, the Darfur region, Christians who are being persecuted. In fact, there's a genocide going on there. The Muslim leadership of that country are wiping out thousands of people in the Darfur region. And, of course, Sudan and its leader have become international pariah. There's a warrant out on the head of the president of Sudan. He can't go anywhere without fear of being arrested and taken to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Okay, so they become an international pariah. Guess who Sudan's only friends are in the world? Apart from Yemen, who's slipping away from them, their only friends are Libya and Iran. You know what Ezekiel 38 verse 6 said? Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, Kush, is joined with Persia and Libya. See, there's things happening there. And just recently they've signed a memorandum of understanding. This is the man who's under a threat of being taken to the International Court for genocide. And they signed that document in Tehran a year or two ago. Now then, well-known and very familiar territory to us, Daniel chapter 2. The image of Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel interprets, there is a God in heaven who revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. So while we rightly and properly use the image of Nebuchadnezzar to talk about four successive world empires and the fifth being the kingdom of God, that's quite appropriate and proper, that was not the purpose of this dream given to King Nebuchadnezzar. It wasn't to talk about the unfolding of history. It was to talk about the latter days. What shall be in the latter days? And we know this is true because in verse 35, when this image is toppled by the stone power, Christ and the saints, and then ground to powder over 40 years, we are told then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together. Now, if they're broken to pieces together, they have to be together. The image has to be complete. It has to stand up complete in the latter days. That's what this was about. This is about a great image empire. And it incorporates all the territories once owned by Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece and Rome. All of those territories and the peoples who now inhabit them have to be brought into the embrace of a dictator, Gog of Ezekiel 38. Let's have a look at these empires in their history. 606 to 539, the Assyro-Babylonian, there was its extent. Not all that big, really. Then along came the Medo-Persian, 539 to 334. It went over here into Macedonia for a short while. It had Egypt. It controlled, of course, a territory right over to the Indus River and slightly beyond. I'm going to talk about that territory here in a moment. The Grecian followed it. Of course, Alexander, who came from Macedonia, took his triumphs right across here to the Indus River when his army refused to go any further. So he possessed approximately the same area as the Medo-Persians before him. But the Roman Empire was different. Here's the Roman Empire at its fullest extent. It only got a toehold on the Persian Gulf for a very short period. Then they were pushed back. They were pushed back to a line.
And Trajan's conquests east of this line, east of the Euphrates, were abandoned by his successor Hadrian in AD 118. And in fact today you can go to modern Jordan and you can go to the Roman forts, or at least the ruins of it, every Roman mile. And there are ruins. They put a line of forts along here to keep these pesky Parthians out, because the Parthians were making life difficult for them. So the point I want to make about this is that Rome never possessed any territory beyond this point here. And what they did possess, they didn't possess for very long. Now Daniel 7 verse 7 says this: "After this I saw in the night visions, and behold a fourth beast." This is Rome. This is amplifying what we read in chapter 2 of Daniel, the legs of iron. "It was dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly. It had great iron teeth." So there's your identifier. "It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now we are told later on in Daniel chapter 7 that this is the beast that Christ will destroy. His body is burnt, it says in Daniel 7 verse 11. So this is the power that Christ deals with. Now the Roman Empire doesn't exist today in the form that it once did. But you see, this is the job. This is the job of the dictator of Ezekiel 38, to put this image empire together, to take all of those countries where the four world empires had control, and to embrace all their peoples, to heap unto himself all peoples, it says in Habakkuk chapter 2. But I want you to notice something. It says he stamped the residue with the feet of it. Residue of what? What residue? We need to ask that question. Well, this is the portion of the three previous empires that Rome never controlled. And you can probably add to that much of this. They got down to here, but they didn't have it for very long. So this is the residue that this fourth beast has to stamp with his feet, which is the language of conquest. It doesn't say he's pussyfooting. It says he's stamping with his feet. So he's going for conquest. Not like the European nations who are embraced by control and black money. This is about conquest. Now, you and I know there's been a lot of things happening in this region in the last 10 years or so. A lot of things going on here. Iraq, of course, is one of them. Afghanistan is another. Canadians are being killed in Afghanistan, aren't they? Pakistan is another. Now, I haven't heard the news for a little while, but when I left home, Pakistan was a mess. It was an ungovernable country almost. And we know, of course, that Russia is moving up here, indicating it means business. Well, brothers and sisters, briefly, Ezekiel 38 verse 6 tells us that there has to be a power called Persia. The Shah of Persia lost power in 1979. He was replaced by a Muslim government, Shiite Muslim government. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein ruled for 30 odd years. He was a Sunni Muslim. And the Sunnis and the Shiites hate each other with a passion. The Shiites are hard line. They hate Israel. They wanted to see the destruction of Israel. Whereas the Sunnis, who govern Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, by the way, want to make peace with Israel. Now, guess what's going to happen? America is going to pull out of Iraq next year. There's going to be a civil war. They know that. They're making different noise, but there will be a civil war. And the majority Shiites will not want to give back any power to the Sunnis. And when that civil war starts between Shiites, Sunnis and Kurds to the north, guess what the Shiite leadership in Iraq will do? Now, I'm no prophet, but I know if I was in their position, I would pick up the phone and I would ring Mr. Ahmadinejad in Tehran, just across the border, and say to him, "Can you come and help us? The Sunnis want to take back control." And the 100%, because that's what it is, Shiite control of Iran, will say, "Yes, our brothers, we will come and help you." And we will have the greater Persia of Ezekiel 38. The old Persia. What about these other countries over here? Well, you know, Pakistan has been the source of some problems. Last year, Mumbai, remember that? Wouldn't want to go to the Taj Mahal Hotel, would you? And you've got India. India, the Eastern Tarshish. Now, brethren and sisters, let me ask you a technical military question. In 1979, the Russians went into Afghanistan. They left humiliated. They lost 50,000 men and squillions in military equipment. They were humiliated. You're a Russian general involved in that as a young man. Someone in Russia says to you, maybe Putin, Medvedev, says to you, we are going to go back into Afghanistan. We're going to take control of it. They've always had a desire to do that, as have many other countries, England included. And all of them have failed. What would you do? You're a general. I'll tell you what I'd do. Now, I'm no military tactician, but I'm not silly either. I know what I would do. There are two mountain ranges. One down here, Khyber Pass. Remember that one? That's where Mr. Bin Laden is hanging out. Okay? They can't find him. It's impregnable. They're deep under the earth, in caves. That's the mountain range, there. Another one that runs up the border of Iran. And this is where the supplies came in to defeat the Russians. This is what's making life so hard for the Americans and the Europeans and the Australians and the Canadians in Afghanistan. Because supplies and weapons can be brought across the border through the mountain range and you can't control it. Send as many drones as you like. So what would you do? I know what I'd do. I'd take Iran and I'd take Pakistan next door. Say to the Afghan Mujahideen, now fellas, what are you going to do now? Eat rocks? It's as simple as that. Cut off their supplies. And when the Russians come back next time, they won't make the same mistake they made in 1979. They will do what Daniel 7 verse 7 says they have to do. They will stamp the residue with the feet of it. And that part of the Roman Empire will become part of the image empire. Nebuchadnezzar's image empire. That's why, brethren and sisters, your news is full of stuff from Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan and India. And has been for years. That's why that's happening. It's heading towards the fulfillment of Bible prophecy. Eastern Tarshish, India. India has the largest navy in the Indian Ocean. It's the Eastern Tarshish. It will be forced into the Western camp. What would you do if you're the leader of India? And the Russians pushed up to the Indus River. Would you say to the Russians, well, look, there's a bit more of Pakistan there, you can have that too? No. You'd come up to the Indus River and say, thus far, no further. So Pakistan will disappear. Once pro-Russian was India, now swinging very much towards the West. Now, very briefly, I'm going to just finish this talk tonight on this financial crisis, which, of course, is affecting most of us in some small way. Timeline of depressions. By the way, brethren and sisters, there are many books coming out nowadays. This is one of them, The Great Depression Ahead. This gentleman who wrote this book, Harry S. Dent, Jr., did not write it on the basis of what is happening right now. He wrote that on the basis of his study of statistics for the last 80 years, since the Great Depression. And he has found there's a pattern, a very distinct pattern, based on the lifespan of so-called baby boomers, people born in the 1950s and 1960s. And he has found evidence, strong evidence, that there will be a depression in the next few years, just based on the spending patterns of the baby boomers, regardless of anything else. And what's happening in the financial world, and a depression is almost a certainty. In 1929, there was a stock market collapse in October, just like there was in 2008 in October, and 1987 in October. Which is an interesting month, by the way, because that's the month, I believe, that the resurrection will occur. Anyway, that's another thing. But depressions go like this. 29? Well, the world leaders... Oh, people were jumping out of buildings in New York, selling Model T Fords for a dollar. They said, we'd better get together. So they got on ships. Didn't have telephones in those days. Or at least,
maybe not like we have them today. They got on ships and they met and they made decisions which guaranteed the depression of 1931. Guaranteed it. The world leaders last year, after the collapse of the stock market, got on the telephones. In fact, they met in New York, remember? And they made decisions about what they would do. And the decisions they made will guarantee a depression. Even they know that. Well, what happened? We know what happened. It took them about 10 years to climb out of this depression. And then only with a war. War was required to dig the world out of depression, to bring it back to times of prosperity. What about our times? Well, 2008. Times of prosperity are in jeopardy, you might say. Depression's coming. Well, we could go through the same cycle again. Sorry. The oil crisis will hit between 2008 and 2012. Did you know, brethren and sisters and young people, that China will use as much oil in 2010, which happens to be next year, because they're registering 14,000 new motor vehicles every day in China. They are building 5 power stations every week in China. They still have a growth rate of 8%. And the experts say, by the way, if it gets to 6, the rest of the world goes into depression. But China will use in 2010 as much oil as the rest of the world, including China, used in 2005. And that the last discovery of any major deposit of oil was in May 2005. That the experts talk about peak oil. Peak oil was May 2005. And we still buy fuel very cheaply. In America, it is $2.50 a gallon, which equates to about 40 cents a litre. Something like that. In Australia, we pay a dollar something a litre, like you do in Canada. So forget about times of prosperity coming back like they did here. You know why they came back here? Cheap oil. Cheap oil. Abundance of oil. It's not going to happen again. But there will be a war. Won't there? There will be a war. And there has to be prosperity when we go. As it was in the days of Noah, says Christ in Luke 17:26 to 30, well-known words to us. So shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day. And the flood came, destroyed them all. Likewise also as it was in the days of Lot. They did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded until the day that Lot went out of Sodom and it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. What's that telling us? It's telling us we will be taken in times of prosperity. People say, oh, but prosperity's gone, has it? I've been going to a few restaurants on this trip and I've walked into a few Walmarts. There's hardly any room to walk. Restaurants are full. We had to wait 20 minutes in New Jersey to get into a restaurant. On a Thursday night. Unbelievable. So they're still eating and drinking and buying and selling and planning and building. Some people have lost their jobs. There's a tent city in Las Vegas, you know. You drive through North Las Vegas, you see hundreds and hundreds of meters of tents, 2- and 3-man tents, because people in that city are suffering. They've lost their jobs, had to leave their houses. They're well-dressed people. And the city had to put toilets there on the street. Not quite sure where they shower. But you see, while they might think times of prosperity are gone, most of us are still living in them, brethren and sisters. And if you want extra proof that we're going to be taken in times of prosperity and not hardship, remember these words in Revelation chapter 3. In the times of Laodicea, the only epistle, the only letter where the Lord says, I stand at the door and knock. It's the time when he comes again. The times of Laodicea in the brotherhood. You know what he says? their problem was?
Rich and increased with goods, having need of nothing. Prosperity had killed them.
We will be taken in times of prosperity, and the Great Depression is coming when people will live in cars and in tent cities and line up at soup kitchens, and Walmart stores will close down. All right? What's that telling you? I know what it's telling me. The possible path to our removal. Predictions of the economy will rebound in 2010, and it probably will. But it will be the same pattern as 1 Thessalonians 5 verses 1 and 2.
When they shall say, oh, we're back. We're on the way back. Boom.
Over the precipice they go. Birth pangs come and go. But one day there's got to be a birth. You know the lesson of Luke 17? Was the struggle between the housetop and the stuff in the house, wasn't it? Same struggle today. The housetop in Israel was used for prayer and meditation. The stuff in the house was what Lot's wife didn't want to leave behind. She couldn't bear the thought that she wouldn't be home the next night to watch the next episode of her favourite soap opera. Couldn't bear that thought. Couldn't leave it behind. The implements, the equipment, the apparatus. She tried to secure the present and lost the future. The Lord's warning to us, brethren and sisters, be watching therefore, for ye know not in what manner of day your Lord is coming. This is Rotherham's translation. But there is one thing ye know, that if the householder had known in what watch the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and not have suffered his house to be dug through. Wherefore ye also be getting ready, because in what hour ye are not thinking, the Son of Man doth come. Remember Lot's wife, was his exhortation. Five times in Luke 17 he uses the term days, plural, the number of grace, days of opportunity. Five times he uses the term day, singular, the day of judgment. And we'll have grace if we've been alert and haven't been like Lot's wife. And then he says, curiously, in verse 34, I say unto you, in that night, his focus has been on days and day, in that night, there shall be two in one bed. Doesn't say men. Two, he means a husband and wife, in the truth. Responsible people like Lot and his wife. What does he say night? He wants you to go back to Genesis 19 and read the chapter, because in the evening the angels came, when you could expect most families to be home together. They came in the evening to take them away. And it says the one shall be left and the other shall be taken. He doesn't mean that one's going to be left behind. The word left means, it's arthiami, it means to be left out of a marriage. The word taken is the word paralambano. It means to be taken into a marriage. He's talking about Lot and his wife. Lot will go into the marriage. He will go into the kingdom. Lot's wife will be turfed out of the marriage. Times of prosperity are disappearing. Let's not make the mistake of Lot's wife. Let's be ready, because it's about to happen, brethren and sisters.